This is not March of 2020. 200 million people are fully vaccinated. We're prepared. We know more. We just have to stay focused. So that's where we stand. Now, let me tell you about the additional steps I'm ordering today to take on what is coming. I know you've heard a lot of this in the news already this morning. 3 weeks ago, I laid out a COVID-19 action plan for this winter that prepared us for this moment. Today, we're making the plan even stronger.
President Biden, in a White House address today, trying to calm nerves about the spread of the Omicron variant of COVID. Biden says his administration is mobilizing 1,000 military medical personnel to help in hospitals around the country. He's ramping up FEMA pop-up vaccination clinics for booster shots, and he's purchasing $500 million at-home rapid COVID tests to send to any American who wants one. Deliveries will begin in January. It's really an about-face from when his press secretary, Jen Psaki, dismissed the notion of mailing millions of tests to Americans earlier this month, but that was before Omicron's rapid and alarming spread. In just 3 weeks, it has already become the dominant variant, accounting for more than 70% of new cases, according to the CDC. Susan Butler Wu is a clinical microbiologist and professor at USC's Keck School of Medicine, and she joins me now to talk about what's happening with Omicron and the current state of COVID testing. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what's your reaction to this announcement that the Biden administration will mail out 500 million rapid tests? Is that going to be effective enough?
I think it is a really positive announcement, and I think it's important to sort of put it into context. I think throughout this pandemic, you know, things have been held up as the sole solution, and this is certainly an important part of trying to get the pandemic tamed. It's not a sole solution, but it's definitely a very positive announcement. I think the big difference this time is, sounds like from the announcement, it's going to be dependent on people essentially going on a website to request it, as opposed to the sort of controversy with the press secretary's comment, which was just automatically mailing it, which I think is a better approach to do, that you request it if you want it.
Right. And I think the previous plan was that you would have to get reimbursed by your insurance company if you're insured. And if you're not insured, well, too bad. So that gets rid of that problem, right?
Exactly. And I think it's a much, you know, we don't know the details of what type of pricing was negotiated between the federal government and the manufacturers of the devices. But I would hope and pray it's a better pricing than what things retail for, which is where the reimbursement from insurance companies would come in. Because, you know, what we know is these types of plans are expensive. So anything we can do, obviously, to keep the cost down would be definitely preferable than going through a sort of standard reimbursement of insurance companies kind of approach.
Right. And it's really hard to get tests now. If you go online and try to buy them or go to the CVS, they're often not available.
Yeah, that has definitely been a challenge throughout. You know, certainly at this time of year now, where there's a high demand, that is definitely, they're a little bit like hen's teeth, as we say in Ireland. They're exceedingly rare. But I do think that one of the things that's important to point out is, or that I hope will be following on from this announcement, is there needs to be a massive educational effort put into having folks understand what these tests do and do not mean, and what they can and cannot do for you. And so, although I think it's a very positive announcement, I think it needs to be accompanied with a lot of education on the part of the American public to interpret them correctly and act appropriately.
Well, let's start with some of that education right now with you, because you are an expert. These tests are largely antigen tests. How effective are they?
So when we think about antigen testing, we need to think about there's two sort of ways these are used, and the answer is a little bit different depending on what the two uses are. So the first is, I'm symptomatic and I'm going to be tested, right? I have symptoms and I want to test myself and see if this could be COVID. So what we know is that the tests perform pretty well. The best time to test is within that first week of symptoms, and that typically, you know, they're going to miss sort of minimum standard to get FDA emergency use authorization, which is the same as the WHO standard, is that you would catch around 4 out of every 5 infections. So obviously, especially, it's complicated now when we have lots of other respiratory viruses circulating, which we didn't have last year. So, you know, on the basis of a negative sole antigen test. If you're symptomatic, you shouldn't assume, especially with Omicron, that it couldn't still be COVID. The second, but obviously if you're symptomatic and it's positive and there's a high prevalence, then that's really great because now you can isolate and take those steps to protect you and your family and, you know, inform folks that you had contact with. The second use is this more sort of more controversial approach, which is using it as a test for asymptomatic people. So it's quite, you know, common now that people are employing testing before they maybe go and socialize and mix with others. And this is where there's a little bit of difficulty. The tests have been sort of stated as if they're an infectiousness test. And I take, as many in the clinical microbiology community do, take exception to that. There is no infectiousness test. And so really the benefit there is if it's positive, you would not go to the gathering. But if it's negative, it doesn't mean that you couldn't still have COVID because any test is just a snapshot of what's happening out your nose at that moment. And certainly with Omicron, what we're seeing is people can test negative and then test positive later. That was the case all along, but there definitely seems to be some funky things happening with Omicron with respect to potential false negative results at first.
And what's the lag time there? Like how much time between a negative test and then a positive test?
Comes down to what we refer to as a limit of detection, right? So every test, you have to have a certain amount of the virus there for it to be able to turn positive. And so the antigen tests tend to be have a higher limit of detection, meaning that you have to have more virus there to detect it. And so when we think about what happens when the virus, you're exposed to the virus and it starts to replicate in your body, that occurs at the rate that it occurs. So if you sample too early, it's going to be negative, and that's why it's important to sample again. So a lot of these tests are recommended for asymptomatic testing to test and then test again, 24 to 36, 48 hours later. Some of this is changing potentially with Omicron, and there's still so much we don't understand. We don't fully understand what viral loads look like in people who are vaccinated versus unvaccinated. And so I think as we head into this, it's important for people to understand that these tests, while really important, are just a single layer. They're not a substitute for being vaccinated. They're not a substitute for getting boosted. And that we should still take other measures. I'd love to see, you know, an opportunity for the federal government to provide better masks to the public if they want them. I think we have to start thinking about this really as a multi-layered process and not just one thing versus the other.
So people are thinking, well, if I get tested an hour before my holiday visit with my friends or family, I am, let's say, triple vaccinated. I'm going to wear a mask outside. Can I go inside then and enjoy my time with my family if they have done all the same things?
This is where it depends on what's going on in your community. Certainly there are anecdotal reports from Europe of people being in that situation and still coming down with COVID. Importantly, you know, the vaccines, the major benefit obviously is protection against hospitalization and death, and for that they have been extraordinarily effective. I think the way to think about the negative test is certainly if it's positive, do not go and get confirmatory testing. And if it's negative, it's reassuring, but it's not a guarantee. You could test again in a couple hours and potentially be positive. So the important thing would be, to be vigilant. Any little sniffle, any little feeling off, don't assume it's a cold. Don't assume it's a cold just on the basis of one of these negative tests being negative. Try to wear masks when you can. Try to ventilate, be in ventilated spaces. We're lucky in California, can be outdoors more. All of those things apply. The more we can do, the more steps we can take, the safer we are.
Susan Butler Wu, clinical microbiologist and professor at USC's Keck School of Medicine. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Well, while the president tries to prepare the country for another huge wave of COVID cases, he's also trying to keep his legislative agenda alive. But his $2 trillion Build Back Better plan looks all but dead after West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin announced he would not vote for it, despite months of back and forth negotiations with the White House. Part of that plan included major reforms aimed at addressing climate change, like shutting down coal plants and moving towards electric cars. Environmental advocates say the policies in this bill were crucial for staving off the worst predictions of the climate change disaster. But There are other routes the Biden administration and even its biggest thorn, Joe Manchin, can take to advance progressive climate policies. And here to talk about what they are two guests, Michael Ross, a professor of political science and environment and sustainability at UCLA, and Rebecca Lieber, covers climate change for Vox. Welcome, both of you.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for having
us. Yeah, it's great to have you. Rebecca, back in October, Manchin expressed concerns about the Clean Electricity Performance Program, and it was cut from the bill, and that was central to the part of the bill, that climate part of the bill. This is where utilities would be incentivized, would have been incentivized to move on to clean energy and not coal. So with that gone, what did Manchin still dislike about the climate provisions in this bill?
Yeah, so the biggest part of this bill was always the clean electricity tax breaks. Now, the clean electricity payment program was stripped out actually to appease Manchin, but the bulk of the funding was still going to go to cleaning up our electricity and improving transmission, all really important for cleaning up other sectors that are very polluting. Mm-hmm. The other parts that he has protested include a methane fee that passed the House version of this bill, and that would have placed a fee on excess pollution of a greenhouse gas called methane from natural gas producers. This is a big contributor to global warming, and Manchin specifically in a statement saying he would not vote for this bill, he talked about having an energy transition happen too fast. And that was likely his oblique kind of discussion of at least this methane bill, this methane fee that is probably not going to go anywhere.
Right. So he said the transition is already happening and to cleaner energy. And Michael, is that the case that companies are already looking at this and saying, well, this is actually in our best interest to do this, so we're going to do it on our own and we don't need a government incentive?
Companies are doing that. Emissions are down in the United States. We had peak emissions about 15 years ago. So they've been declining for some time, but not nearly fast enough. Not nearly fast enough to get anywhere close to the global goal of limiting warming to 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. The Build Back Better bill, even though it was mostly, you know, pitched for its other features, really, I think, had at its core the major part of the Biden climate agenda, which was to move the country toward a 50% reduction in emissions by 2030. And with this gone, if it's not revived in some form, it's going to be very difficult to come anywhere close to that goal.
And so is it still somewhat alive? Are they still negotiating, or Rebecca, or is this just really dead and people will have to look to other alternatives?
Well, that's the part that's still unclear here. The White House is certainly talking about this as if it's still live and there is a path forward with Manchin. His comments were really clear on Sunday that he was not going to vote for this legislation, but there's been a lot of parsing over whether he would be open to a different form, a radically different version that could pass through reconciliation next year. The place where Democratic leadership agrees, climate activists agree, is that something needs to pass, that this is a critical window to pass major climate investments to make that transition this next decade. So I think we would expect to see some kind of vehicle next year to get at least some of these programs through. It's unclear whether it looks anything like the original Build Back Better, or it's going to be radically pared down and very different.
It's interesting that the union that represents coal miners in West Virginia and around the country has asked Manchin to reconsider his no vote. I mean, he has said that he is supporting the interests of his voters in West Virginia, but at least this part of his constituency seems to have wanted him to make another decision. How effective or how influential, Michael, can this union be in persuading Manchin to reconsider?
Well, apparently they're not getting much traction. They came out with a statement yesterday flatly asking Senator Manchin to reconsider and support this bill, because the Biden administration, you know, they're not stupid. They know that in order to get this legislation through, they would have to get support from mine workers who are going to be put out of work. And so there's actually a good bit of money in here for the health concerns, for sort of reconstruction and new development in the coal mining areas. So the mine workers, you know, saw this and realized it's ultimately to their benefit. Hmm. On top of that, the coal industry is collapsing on its own. So it's not really clear if this is going to speed things up for the coal industry in any way. But apparently they're not getting Manchin's ear at this point.
It's interesting that there are only, well, fewer than 40,000 coal miners in this country. It is a dying industry, as you say.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, that actually gets at something that's really, really interesting, which is that many of them are in swing states, states that were once blue and are now red. Ohio, Indiana, West Virginia, Virginia. So this is a critical constituency, and the whole economy and culture around these communities has moved away from the Democrats and towards the Republicans and towards a kind of a anti-climate position.
Rebecca, we have just about a minute left, but I'm wondering if Democrats are now talking about carving this out into a separate bill that's not part of this big, huge social spending bill, and if that's a possibility in terms of getting some legislation passed.
There are a couple challenges to do that. One is that there's just the timeline ahead that Democrats kind of almost expect to lose seats in the next midterm election. So they only have a limited amount of time to pass something. If they are dropping some of these, some programs, then there's also the risk that you lose support, not just from Manchin, but possibly progressives like in the House who have wanted to see strong progress on social spending and climate provision. So I think what we've heard from Biden, what we've heard from the Senate leadership, like Chuck Schumer, is that they are committed to finding a path forward, that they're going to, if nothing else, have a vote on Build Back Better to put on the record Manchin's position. I think everyone's operating from this position that something must pass because the climate crisis will not wait around for these politics to get better. So it's still key to keep these investments high, especially targeting electricity, clean cars, and other polluting sectors. But we'll just have to see.
Rebecca Lieber covers climate change for Vox. Michael Ross is a professor of political science and environment and sustainability at UCLA. Thank you both.
Thanks. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, a local doctor is trying to deliver food to Afghanistan as most of the country cannot afford basic needs. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. In Afghanistan, aid groups are warning that more than a million children could die this winter. And that's because Afghanistan is crumbling. After the U.S. withdrew in August, it withdrew its financing, too. Billions of dollars in public spending have disappeared. There's also a crippling drought. And now most Afghans can't afford enough food or fuel. Today, we're going to check back in with someone who's been trying to help. Dr. Mina Syed is an endocrine surgeon here in Santa Monica and the founder of Wellness Worldwide. That's a small NGO that delivers food and medical care to families throughout Afghanistan. Welcome back to Press Play, Dr. Syed.
Thank you for having me.
Well, your group started out initially as a way to help kids with cancer in Afghanistan, and then it's now evolved into delivering food. And last time we spoke in October, you told us that winter is coming. Well, now winter is here, and you were afraid of what would transpire, and have your fears been unfortunately realized?
Yes, indeed they have. Things are getting a lot worse on the ground. Last when we spoke, I described how there were community leaders and village elders calling us for help to come see their villages, to see the starvation and to help them. So these calls have just increased significantly. And when I last spoke to you, mostly you would see the children with severe malnutrition in the hospital children wards. Now these children are pouring out into the streets. One hospital in Kabul just treated 3,000 children over the last 3 months. And no one is really keeping track of the deaths. So children are dying, and if there's nobody to feed them, then indeed there's nobody to count the dead.
Mm. So when you're talking about treating 3,000 children, treating them for starvation?
Correct. Treating them for starvation and malnutrition, they require a special regimen to be healthy again. You can't just feed children. It's a lot more complex because they're sick and they have different things that need to be addressed, and you can't just feed children. That could actually make them worse.
So how are you trying to work with people on the ground to help? What are they doing, the people that you're working with?
Well, from our end here, we have to do fundraising to obtain the funds so that we can help them on the ground. They are doing assessments of the different regions that require help and obtaining permission from the local government. They have to obtain permission from the Taliban NGO head. Every province has one. And then our team also works with, again, the community leaders and village elders to get information on which families we have to target who are the most in need. But unfortunately, it's really hard for us to even decide who to feed and who not to feed because so many people need food.
Does it surprise you how fast this has happened?
No, Madeline, because as we discussed before, prior to when the Taliban came, 50% of the population was already in poverty, and we were already dealing with food insecurity. And ever since August, when they first took over, all of the aid organizations who have experience were sounding the alarm that this precipitous decline in the humanitarian situation was going to happen, and here we are.
Oh. My gosh. Well, so is the problem, because last time we spoke, there were supplies. It was just a matter of getting them to the families. Is there enough actual food in the country? And the problem is that it's just not getting distributed or it's too expensive?
So there's no lack of supply of food in general. There's some in the country, and then there's some that's brought in by the merchants. But there's multiple reasons it cannot reach the people on the ground or the people who are hungry. One is that because the banking system has collapsed, the merchants in, for example, surrounding countries have increased their prices. The other reason is that large humanitarian aid organizations, because of the sanctions, even though they do have enough money to feed the population, to buy the food, they're not able to get money into the country because the banking system is essentially collapsed.
So what should the West do, in particular the United States, to immediately try to alleviate the suffering?
There can be a special bank that's created whereby the UN can be the administrator and overseer of that bank, where the frozen funds and all humanitarian aid can be funneled through that bank directly to the population, thereby avoiding giving it to the Taliban. And we can still do this. And if the larger humanitarian organizations are not able to get money through the banking system, then one can buy the food from all the surrounding countries and do a mass distribution within the country by transporting it in.
But don't they have to go through the Taliban gatekeepers? Isn't that the problem?
The Taliban, no, that's not the problem, because there's trade routes already open. And that's how, when we were talking before about the Pakistani traders, all of these trade routes are open. And the Taliban are not obstructing us or anybody else from getting aid. And we've been there for 5 months functioning with our children's program, with our clinic, and with our food program. And we haven't been obstructed so far.
And so, what is the most urgent need right now? Because as you said, the financial system has collapsed, but so has the healthcare system. So it seems like there are problems on all fronts.
Yes, these are the two most important sectors that we need to support. I already described what the immediate solution may be for the food. And for the hospital or the health sector, there has been some support by the Red Cross, and they've been able to support some of the hospitals. But widely, the problem is that the staff don't have their salaries for the last 5 months. So even the doctors and the staff are going hungry, and the supplies are short. So for example, in an major eastern city called Jalalabad, there's a medical school. They're short of supplies. They haven't had their salaries, and there's no medicines. So patients just don't go to the hospital, or if they go, they have to go to the market and buy their own medicines and buy their own IVs and supplies to try to get their treatment administered by doctors in the hospital.
So if people listening to this right now want to help, what should they do?
Well, there's, of course, you can donate to our organization, and our website is wellnessworldwideprojects.org. But in general, awareness is very important, and one can exercise their democracy here, call or write to your elected officials and urge them to work hard and immediately to alleviate this mass starvation, because this is a man-made catastrophe and we have the ability to alleviate it.
I want to thank you so much for coming back on the program, and best of luck with your efforts in Afghanistan.
Thank you again, Madeline. Thank you.
Dr. Mina Syed, she's an endocrine surgeon in Santa Monica and founder of the NGO Wellness Worldwide. Again, her website is wellnessworldwideprojects.org. Coming up, going back to a much simpler time, the 1990s, and the origins of the Beanie Baby craze.
They were created to be played with. And as with all things that adults get their hands on, adults ended up ruining it.
A new documentary on how the craze began with a few moms in the Midwest and then took over the country. That's next on Press Play.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Earn your graduate degree in a flexible online format from University of Southern California and learn from faculty at the top of their fields in areas such as business, health, law, engineering, psychology, communications, and more. Explore your options today at online.usc.edu.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. 2 decades ago, a collectibles dealer named Phyllis Maselli got a phone call from a Marine stationed in Hawaii. He said, "Can you handle a large account?" She said, "Of course," but she didn't trust sending her precious cargo through the mail.
So we hopped on a plane and hand carried them to Hawaii. His wife went to the bathroom and he handed me $20,000 cash. And he said, "Don't tell my wife what I paid for these." My husband and I both thought it was totally crazy. And we got back to the hotel room and we threw the money on the bed.
Well, it was totally crazy because her product wasn't stolen artwork or looted antiquities or bricks of cocaine. The product was Beanie Babies. Remember them? Those tiny pellet-filled stuffed animals that were all the rage in the late 1990s? Remember Peanut, the royal blue elephant, or Princess, the purple teddy bear? They were supposed to pay for your kids' college at the peak of all this mania or fund your retirement until it all came crashing down like a dot-com startup. Cryptocurrency for the Y2K era. Yemisi Brooks tells the story of this Beanie Baby boom and bust in her new documentary. It's called Beanie Mania. It debuts Thursday night on HBO Max. Yemisi, welcome to Press Play.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Well, were you part of this mania? Did you have Beanie Babies and love them?
Do you know what? I wasn't. As you can probably tell from my accent, I am not from the States. So I was over the pond in the UK, kind of watching from afar. But I never really realised quite how big it was until I started working on this show and then realised that it really was quite out of control.
Yeah.
So yes, I now realise what a huge phenomenon they were.
Well, let me play a montage from your movie, which illustrates that.
We called every shop over the United States. Our phone bills for 1 month were almost $2,000.
The doorbell rings. Here, you're being served. Served?
With this little purple bear in my pocket. Do you know that if people knew I had this, I could be mugged on the streets of Chicago?
And then I thought, oh my God, I gotta just hire off-duty policemen to stand by my table.
Well, they found the truck the next day, but it was completely empty. It had about $500,000 worth of product on it. That was a point probably in time where I went, wow, this is really, really out of control.
Okay. We all want to know, and I guess you did too, how this all started. And you trace it to a few women, moms, in the Chicago area. How did it begin there and why?
Yeah. What happened was that there were some kind of soccer mums living in Naperville that started seeing these small toys kind of appearing and were like, wow, these are great. You know, the kids have got enough money with their pocket money that they can get a few of those. And they just really became addicted. And I think part of what was exciting for them was a few things, one of which was that they didn't know where they were going to pop up next. So you couldn't just go to a Walmart or something like that and get all of them. You really had to go on a bit of a treasure hunt. And so initially this started out as something which mums would do with their kids, you know, and it was like a fun after school activity. And then what really happened over the years is the mums really kind of took over. And of course, then from there, it kind of, you know, went stratospheric. And I guess the story that we tell in the film is really how they created this whole secondary market without which the phenomenon wouldn't really have existed.
Right, because that's when the Beanie Babies become extraordinarily expensive. They're not $5 anymore.
Yeah.
They can fetch what?
Exactly.
Thousands of dollars people were paying for them at one point?
Yeah, I mean, in their peak, people were going mad for them. You know, thousands, people were paying thousands. And actually, Mary Beth, who is one of the contributors in the show, she talks about on the film how she was offered $100,000 for her collection and she said no, because those Beanie Babies really meant something to her, you know? And the sort of funny thing is now, you know, if you think $100,000 in the late 90s was a lot, that probably wasn't even the most that people were offering at the time. People really wanted those Beanie Babies.
So how did it travel from this suburb of Chicago, Naperville, and the obsession of these few moms into this nationwide phenomenon
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Particularly in a world now where we're so used to, you know, social media as kind of fueling crazes and excitement. But really, these women, just in the beginning, they started writing about Beanie Babies and they started kind of doing press and talking about it. And then word of mouth really just kind of like spread throughout the country, where when they went to other cities, they would start looking in, you know, smaller toy stores or gift shops for them. And the craze really just kind of spread like that. Also, though, what did help them at the time was kind of the advent of the internet. So the internet was starting to go into people's homes. So people were having, if you kind of remember, like chat rooms were kind of being created. So instead of just ringing people, you know, there was this kind of new way by which you could maybe go into a chat room and ask people if they had certain Beanie Babies. And then that was followed by eBay. And there was a period of time in eBay's early days when a huge amount of their kind of sales on the site were due to Beanie Babies, because it really became a place that you could trade and buy and sell beanies. The other thing was there were no kind of official lists. So these women out of Chicago were the kind of holders of the information. And it was just because they were kept very methodical, particularly Becky, who we feature in the film.
Ty was not giving us any information whatsoever. It was a blank slate. We had no idea what was available, how many were available, when they were produced. We had to find this all out on our own. What we did was we would take every beanie, list the dates that they were introduced. So this is our first attempt at putting our beanie a chronology together.
And so it became like a real thing, that it was like, you know, she's writing this list, she's ticking them off, she's calling other collectors to find out, hey, Peanut the Royal Blue Elephant is a new one that no one else has seen. And she would kind of note that down. So that treasure hunt part of it, I think, really was a big part of the appeal also.
And this is mainly adults doing this, not kids.
Yeah, so the interesting thing is it switched from kids to adults really pretty quickly, which sort of seems mad, doesn't it? When you think, like, why do grown-ups want to kind of collect these $5 beanbag toys? But yeah, it was interesting as well to find that they were created to be played with, right? That's the whole thing about Beanie Babies, is they're kind of posable because they're these sack-like things that you can drape around your shoulder, or you can put it, you know, on the top of your TV. And kids loved it. They could throw it in a backpack. They could put it in their pocket. But what ended up changing, and I think there's a really nice part of the film where one of our contributors says, and as with all things that adults get their hands on, adults ended up ruining it. Because what happened was then adults were like, well, maybe this is worth something. So let me just put some tag protectors on the little heart-shaped tags. Actually, let me put them in a clear box. Actually, let me put them up on the shelf. So what originally kind of started out as an innocent child's toy then obviously, you know, had a lot of monetary value behind it. And the way in which Beanie Babies were used really kind of began to change.
And how did Ty feel about this? Ty Warner, the creator, was he happy there was this frenzy on the secondary market?
Well, we'll never know, because he's super elusive. He really does not kind of like to be, he doesn't do press, he doesn't like to be in the spotlight. So yeah, we just don't know. All we know is that his sales went up and up and up, and he always kept the price point the same. So he always kept the price point at that kind of $5. He carried on selling just through those smaller stores. But undoubtedly, the secondary market was driving sales of the primary market, which I think is really interesting, when that kind of, you know, that took over, and the secondary market, which was driven by these women, really informed the primary market.
All right. I want to play a clip of tape from a collector who got the fuzzy end of that lollipop.
Okay.
And her name is Janine Tordes.
Janine.
Yeah. And here she is talking about some of the financial problems she faced because of Beanie Babies.
There was always a little bit of financial problems, and it's still haunting me to this date. So I get by, but it's hard. Yeah, it's been hard. Like I said before, it's more like Beanie Baby bankruptcy. Because I didn't sell a lot of stuff. I don't know what would have happened if I had sold them all and made a lot of money then. It would have made things easier now, that's for sure. Maybe I could have paid that off the house sooner. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, so there were a lot of Beanie Baby addicts. And What happened when the bust occurred? Because, you know, for every insane boom, there is a bust. And what happened with Beanie Babies?
So, as I understand it, there was a very small slice or window of time in which you could have made a lot of money on Beanie Babies. And very few people kind of sold at that time, because I guess everyone thinks that the bubble's not quite going to pop. So you think, let me just hold on a little bit longer and they'll just appreciate in value and they'll just appreciate in value. And of course, that doesn't always happen. So yeah, there was a very small window of time. Most people kept their beanies for longer than that. And actually what happens, you know, whenever we talk to people now, which we do all the time, everyone says, but are they going to be worth something still? And, you know, surely they're worth something. You know, my mum or my dad has them at this, you know, huge pile of them in Tupperware in the basement. Are they going to come back? And I just don't know if that's the case. A lot of people are holding on to them. And a lot of people had spent, you know, so much time driving around the country, going to Beanie Baby conventions, getting the price guides, calling round. And for a lot of people, whilst I think they enjoyed the experience, it just didn't pay them back in the way that maybe they thought it was going to.
Well, it certainly changed the lives of these original women from Naperville. And one of them, Peggy Gallagher, she still makes money and has made a lot of money off this, right? Because she has styled herself as an authenticator of the real Beanie Babies, because, of course, there are all sorts of counterfeit ones. And people pay her to authenticate to this day their Beanie Babies?
They do. She's fantastic. She was the first person that we interviewed. And yeah, she's just amazing. So we went to her house, which is in Naperville, and the whole basement is devoted to Beanie Babies. And at its height, you know, when things were really nuts, so late 90s, her and a team of women would be down there in a kind of lineup, just receiving packages, which were being brought by the UPS guy, opening them and authenticating. And it was like a factory line down there. Now, it's not like that today, but even just on the day that we were there filming with her, the UPS man was turning up with Beanie Babies that people need or wanted to be authenticated. And I ask her, and I think it's actually in the film, I say, do you not get sick of this?
No, because I love Beanie Babies. I don't get sick of it. I charge like $25. I bought display cases. I got tamper-evident tape, certificates. This is the one I write all the details of the Beanie Baby, the generation, the authentication number, which would be number 125,878.
Just read that again. How many Beanie Babies have you authenticated?
125,877. Isn't that amazing?
At $20 or $25 a pop?
it even shocks me.
And it was really like seeing a master at work when she gets these Beanie Babies. She opened the package, which she got when we were there. You know, she opens it and just from looking, she's like, nope, fakes. Whereas, you know, to my untrained eye, at that point, I think I've got a bit better, but at that point, I wouldn't have been able to tell. Maybe by touching the fabric and looking at the stitching. But she's like, nope. And she still does it and she still loves it. And, you know, she's a real, really much loved figure in that whole kind of beanie community. So, yeah, she is not stopping.
And she makes $20 a pop and she's done.
She does.
What? Nearly 200,000 of these. So she's made a lot of money doing this.
So you can do the math. She's doing okay. Yeah.
But what is she authenticating if they're not really worth anything anymore anyway? Like, who cares?
Well, this is the thing. I think there is still, people are still hopeful. People are still optimistic that maybe they still will come back around, or, you know, maybe there will be a reason, or there'll be a new boom and, you know, these will really take off again. And people just want to know that whether they have the real deal or not. So I think while that business is there, she's still happy to authenticate.
Ah, the American optimism.
Exactly.
Did it whet your appetite? Do you want a Beanie Baby now?
I mean, here's the thing. At the beginning, so I was on this project for 10 months. At the beginning, I was like, yeah, they're kind of cute, but I can't really see how people get obsessed with them. By the end, I can tell you, you know, it's my new specialist subject. I could tell you, you know, when they were made, I'm looking at them now in my sitting room. I was like, oh, maybe I'll just get one, you know, and I'm looking at the pile of them now and I've got 20. So, yeah, and it's very easy, I think, to be slightly cynical about it and think, oh, I wouldn't have got involved. But looking at the pile of them, you know, however many years later in my sitting room, I sort of defy anyone to not fall a little bit in love with them.
Yamsey Brooks, her new documentary is called Beanie Mania. It debuts this Thursday night on HBO Max. Yamsey, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, good foods. Evan Kleinman is here with some hot holiday drink recipes. Don't go anywhere. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb sauce?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15 minutes bake off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom, flames.
Bam, that's a little bit like that.
Pie.
It's officially winter as of today, and it really feels like it. At least for us here in Southern California, anyway. We are wimps when it comes to cold weather. Well, here with some ideas to help us keep warm on these chilly, chilly nights is Evan Kleinman. She hosts KCRW's Good Food. Hi, and I'm so glad it's cold, actually, because if it were warm, it'd be really depressing.
Yes, I always find it very depressing when it's like 75.
Oh, 75 in December. All right. So one thing that we can use to keep us toasty is mulled wine. That's a classic this time of year. Talk about that.
There are so many great warm drinks that we can enjoy throughout the holiday season. And of course, you know, mulled wine is a classic. Almost all of the drinks that we're talking about today have these amazing aromas of like cinnamon, cloves, ginger, nutmeg, maybe star anise or cardamom, you know, stewing in some kind of tasty liquid. Mm-hmm. So mulled wine is usually just choice of those kind of warm spices, maybe a few slices of orange to lift the whole thing, and a not too dry red wine. So easy to make.
And so any amounts?
I have links for all of these drinks that we're going to talk about on the web for everyone. But I should say that all of these drinks have as many variations as there are people who make them. So just enjoy yourself, really.
And when you're making mulled wine, is there a danger that you might boil off the alcohol and then you've just got hot grape juice?
Yes, which is why you never really want it to come to a boil. This is when, if you do have a slow cooker, any one of us who still has one, is really useful, because you really want, you need to allow those spices to stew to get the flavor to transfer to the liquid, but you don't really want it to come to anything more than a really, really low simmer, and not even that.
Okay, that's mulled wine, and I often confuse that with grog, which is similar, but it sounds like a lot more potentially dangerous.
Yeah, I think maybe the alcohol content increases the farther north you go, which is totally understandable.
Yeah.
So grog tends to be very boozy. The link I have for everyone is one that Marcus Samuelson grew up making, and it combines wine with vodka or aquavit and maybe port or Madeira.
Ooh.
So it's super boozy.
All of that in one?
Yes, with the spices.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, one cup and you're good.
That's when you want little tiny punch cups,
right,
to drink
exactly,
it with.
Exactly. Okay, so what if you want something that has no alcohol in it? What would you recommend?
Well, there are a couple drinks that I think are great because you can make up a batch, and people who want it non-alcoholic can drink it non-alcoholic, and people who want a little something-something can just put a little bit in their mug of rum or brandy or anything that goes well with the drink. But I think like the greatest holiday warm drink is Mexican ponche, which means punch. And I think what's really great about it is how it's made. It's made with this wide variety of fruit and water. So it isn't like apple cider, which tends to be really one note unless you add, you know, pineapple juice to it or a ton of orange and lemon juice to it. Ponche's made with a mixture of guavas, pears, crab apples, dried fruit like prunes, and sugar cane. And all these ingredients you can find at Latino markets this time of year. And if you can't find sugar cane, but I saw some at a market last week, it comes canned. So you could use that. And then there people add, you know, piloncillo, which is the cone of like very deep brown sugar.
And where would you get that?
Also Latino market. You could use a, like a muscovado, really deep brown sugar. I make my own brown sugar just using white sugar and molasses. So if you have molasses in the house and you want a deeper flavored brown sugar than what you have, just add a teaspoon or so of molasses to whatever you want to have that flavor. And also one of the ingredients that I really love in ponche are tamarind pods, which add their, you know, traditional sour, or jamaica, you know, dried hibiscus flowers.
That sounds so good.
So good.
This sounds like something you could drink all year round.
Yeah. Or, and also I think cold. I mean, it's the thing that once you have made it, if you have leftovers, then just decant it, put it in the fridge.
So it does sound a little more interesting than, as you say, mulled apple cider, but I do like a good hot apple cider.
Yeah, and it's the simplest, really. I mean, here in Southern California, we have access to really great seasonal fresh cider, and just throw some warming spices that you love into it. And I would add a little splash of lemon juice, maybe some lemon zest or orange zest studded with a couple of cloves. And it's certainly easy.
And then maybe you'd add a little rum.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
Rum, or I think with cider, I also think like brandy and bourbon go well with cider.
Yeah.
Not to mention Calvados, if you happen to have that hanging around.
Okay, what about good old-fashioned hot chocolate?
Oh, gosh. I've just been drinking hot chocolate on repeat in this climate. I really, really love it, and I make it all different kinds of ways. I love Mexican chocolate. Sometimes if I don't have the tablets of Mexican chocolate themselves, I'll just add some spices to my hot chocolate. I love cinnamon. And I really think that this time of year, just give yourself the extra special oomph of a toasted marshmallow on top.
How do you do that if you're not around a campfire?
Well, you know, I like to live on the edge, so I just put the marshmallow on a fork and toast it over the stove. But if you're not up for that, you can put the marshmallows on a parchment-lined cookie sheet and slide them under the broiler for a minute.
And do you use Swiss Miss or no? Is that just...
No. I mean, no, because all you have to do is take a great bar of chocolate, break it up, put it in your cup, heat up some milk or a mixture of milk and cream, or a mixture of milk and water, or a mixture of coffee and cream, and pour it in your cup, and it will melt the chocolate. And it's easier than Swiss Miss.
And much tastier.
Obviously. Oh my gosh, so much tastier.
And then do you add a little something in there?
In the past, I have added, I love mocha, so I've added Kahlua. I also happen to have some maple liqueur in the house, and that is really delicious. But so is anything peppermint flavored, like even a peppermint vodka or schnapps or amaretto. And I have to say, this is going to be out of left field, but red wine.
What?
I know. But red wine and chocolate are really good together.
Oh, I mean, okay. I've had red wine with some chocolate on the side, so I guess why not together?
Yeah, so, you know, if you're a household that's making mulled wine and you want hot chocolate, you could combine them.
Now you're thinking. All right, well, that all sounds delectable, delicious, irresistible. Thank you. And happy holidays. I will see you in the new year.
You too. Have a wonderful, relaxing holiday, Madeline.
Thank you. You too. That's Evan Kleiman, the host of KCRW's Good Food. And you can find links to all the drink recipes that she mentioned at kcrw.com. And that will do it for us today. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. Happy drinking. I'll see you tomorrow.